We're sending a flying machine to Titan this week on Planetary Radio. Welcome. I'm Matt Kaplan of the Planetary Society with more of the human adventure across our solar system and beyond. NASA announced on June 27th that the Dragonfly rotorcraft will explore Saturn's marvelous moon. We'll welcome back Principal Investigator Zibby Turtle for an update on this thrilling mission. And when we get to this week's What's Up, Bruce Betts will tell us the latest news about LightSail 2. The little CubeSat is in great shape, but deployment of its big wings has been delayed a bit further. There are so many worthy missions of exploration and discovery that never get the opportunity to explore our solar system and beyond. It's a long, hard road just to get the green light from NASA or another space agency, and then the work has just begun. But it's reason to celebrate, and that's why I've invited Elizabeth Zibby Turtle back to Planetary Radio. Zibby became one of our first guests back in March of 2003. We talked back then about icy worlds like Mars and Europa. Now she will lead a mission to yet another frigid globe, but one that is in some ways more like our own warm Earth than any other body in our solar neighborhood. Dragonfly will be a nuclear-powered 8-rotor science powerhouse, able to fly high above Titan's surface and then set down for extended stays at the most intriguing spots on Saturn's big moon. I caught Zibby as she was in the United Kingdom wrapping up attendance at a conference. She was kind enough to spend a few minutes bringing us up to date on this exciting mission. Zibby, welcome back to Planetary Radio, and congratulations from all of us at the Planetary Society. I cannot tell you how thrilled we all were to hear that we're going to be sending a flying machine to this moon of Saturn. Again, congratulations.
Thank you very much. It's so exciting to be looking ahead to going to explore Titan in situ.
How did you learn that Dragonfly had been selected as part of the NASA's New Frontiers program? I mean, where were you?
I was in my office, and I got a call from Thomas Zurbuchen.
Oh, that's great. Right from almost the top, from Thomas Zurbuchen himself, who has, among others, said a lot of great things about this mission, including the NASA administrator, Jim Bridenstine, who said that this mission, which was unthinkable not many years ago, it's just terrific that basically we're able to take this on now. I mean, he's right, right? I mean, this is just not something that could have been considered not long ago.
The timing has really come together well in a number of different areas for this mission. We have the scientific information from Cassini and Huygens about Titan's surface and about its atmosphere. And we have the technology in the payload. A lot of the technology that we're using is based on technology that's on the surface of Mars or has operated on other spacecraft missions. And then this revolution in rotorcraft technology and autonomous navigation. The timing, it couldn't be better in terms of the opportunity to do this mission, because we're really not having to invent anything at this point. The innovation is taking these existing technologies and applying them to exploring Titan.
That is great to hear. And I'm so glad that you mentioned Cassini-Huygens. Could you have considered a mission like Dragonfly without Cassini-Huygens having delivered all of the data and the success that it did?
We could have considered a similar mission, but the information, the details about the surface, Cassini has really shown us where we need to go to take the next steps in answering questions about the habitability and prebiotic chemistry on Titan. And so it certainly informs the questions and the mission design to be able to answer those questions. But people have been talking about flying on Titan since before the Cassini mission. We've known that flight would be a good way to explore Titan for a couple of decades at this point.
I didn't know that. Let's talk a little bit about the spacecraft before we talk more about where you're going to go on this big moon and what you hope to find, where you'll be visiting. I've watched a lot of your videos on the APL website, and we'll put a link up, of course, to the Dragonfly site there, along with some links to some of our past conversations on the show page at planetary.org/radio. It includes an animation of Dragonfly's entry, descent, and landing. And watching it, I could almost fool myself that I was watching Curiosity come down to Mars. at least until Dragonfly was released and actually flies down to the surface. So it is a flying machine right from the point of its arrival.
Yes, absolutely. There are a couple of differences for Dragonfly. One is that the Titan atmosphere is actually very extended because the gravity is very low on Titan comparatively. And so the entry sequence is 2 hours long, as opposed to the very short sequences we're used to on Mars. And that means we have a lot of time to phase all the different activities in the during the entry, descent, and landing sequence. And then, yes, at the end, we don't need a separate landing system to take us down to the surface because Dragonfly can fly away from the back shell and descend to the surface on its own power.
So many reasons for those Mars folks to be jealous or envious of you.
It's easier to fly on Titan. that is, that's true.
Yeah, by far. Although, of course, we wish that little helicopter on the 2020 rover the best of luck as well.
Exactly. Absolutely. I mean, it's great to be, you know, to be developing the technology for two different destinations in parallel. That's a lot of fun.
Well, let's talk more about the mission and what you hope to accomplish. I saw that you're going to be starting out in this dune field called Shangri-La.
Yes, yeah, so the Shangri-La CNC Dragonfly will target the northwestern reaches of the Shangri-La CNC, and this is one of these areas with longitudinal dunes that Cassini has characterized quite well. We have data from the Cassini Imaging Science Subsystem, Cassini ISS, from the Visual and Infrared Mapping Spectrometer, or VIMS, and from the Cassini radar. All have covered this area. And so we have data from multiple types of instruments to assess the nature of the surface here. The CNCs, the longitudinal dunes, are particularly good in a number of ways as an initial landing site. And that's because although we tend to think about deserts or sand seas as being entirely sand, these longitudinal dune fields, actually a substantial fraction of the material is these exposed interdune areas. And so one of the reasons we want to target this area is that on Titan, the dunes are made of organic material, not like the silicate sand we have on Earth. And the interdunes often have a water ice component. And that means that in our initial landing site, in very close proximity, there are two different types of material that we'd be able to sample and characterize. So it's a very scientifically appealing landing site. It's also, from the perspective of designing a system to land on Titan, having wide, flat areas is another attractive aspect of the longitudinal dunes, or the interdunes per se.
You've provided more evidence of just the wonder of this world, Titan, and how very different it is from our own planet, and yet how very similar. I mean, you can see this in the animations that I was talking about earlier, where you could almost believe in those animations that Dragonfly was flying over dunes here on Earth that were made of silicate sand. But this is a very different place.
Yeah, it's amazing how familiar Titan is. It's, out at Saturn's orbit, it's much colder, and the materials are very different. You know, the bedrock is made of water ice. The atmosphere is mostly nitrogen, but has a methane component. And so the rain and clouds and lakes and rivers and seas are liquid methane instead of liquid water. And yet the features that we see are very familiar. And so that's it's fascinating that such similar processes occur, similar geologic processes, similar interactions between the atmosphere and the surface that we're very familiar with here on Earth in this environment that is so fundamentally, or seems so fundamentally different.
You've got a 2.5 year baseline mission. How much ground do you hope to cover in that period, beginning at this Shangri-La dune field or sand sea?
What we want to be able to do with Dragonfly is measure the composition of Titan's solid surface materials in different environments, different geological settings, where the materials have had different histories. The dunes are a great starting place because we know that there's organic material there. It's been widely sourced from across Titan. And so that allows us, even in a single location, perhaps to sample materials that have come from a broad region, or perhaps even globally distributed on Titan. And then in the course of the mission, we traverse toward an impact crater through its ejecta field and then into the impact crater itself, where in the past there will have been liquid water on the surface of Titan, and it may have had the opportunity to mix with these organic materials. And so that's one of the other reasons we've chosen this landing site, is that there's proximity to these other geologic settings associated with the Selk impact crater. So how far we need to travel depends to some extent on where we land in the landing ellipse. But really for Dragonfly, the journey is the goal, because it's along the journey that we will be finding different materials that will be able to sample the diversity of the materials on Titan and to get progressively into these impact crater deposits where the organics will have been able to mix with liquid water.
So do you expect that some of where you will send, some of the destinations you may send Dragonfly to, we're not even aware of right now, that you may actually say, my goodness, those hills just over that way, maybe a kilometer away, look like they're worth taking a look at?
Yes, I mean, that's been one of the fun things with the rovers on Mars, right? Adding mobility to exploration gives you so many different options. And we'll be able to take aerial data to scout future landing sites with Dragonfly as we fly out to scout landing sites, come back to the landing site, and send the data back to Earth. I'm sure there'll be all sorts of fascinating discussions about where we should go next. It's going to be a lot of fun to figure out, to decide, you know, all of the different things that we'll be able to explore. I'm sure, like we found on Mars, there will be more places we want to go than we can get to at one time.
Fascinating discussions. I would expect some heated ones as well. But that's your job as PI, I guess, to resolve that stuff. Are you going to let Dragonfly, are you going to send Dragonfly anywhere near liquid on the surface of Titan? The seas, the flowing liquid, the liquid methane sounds a little bit hazardous, but wouldn't that be interesting?
It'd be fascinating. We are landing at low latitude. That's for a couple of reasons, as we talked about. But one of those reasons is that the low latitudes are going to be the most efficient place to communicate with Earth. Another is that the solid surface materials are one of the big outstanding mysteries after Cassini, the compositions of those materials. And those are going to carry the keys to a lot of the questions we have about prebiotic chemistry. But of course, the lakes and seas on Titan are tantalizing destinations. On Titan, the lakes and seas are mostly seen at high latitudes. There's some hints that maybe there are some lakes at lower latitude, but the really definitive evidence is at higher latitudes. And when Dragonfly arrives, it will be northern winter. And so the high northern latitudes will not be illuminated. And if the sun isn't up, the Earth isn't going to be up in the sky either. And so direct-to-Earth communication becomes a challenge from the surface of Titan. But there would be absolutely fascinating processes at the shorelines of these features. One can dream of extended missions wherein Dragonfly can go further and further afield and perhaps dip the skids in the shores of an alien sea.
A little tide pool on the shores of Titan. Well, I'll join you in that dream.
or perhaps we'll find evidence of liquids at lower latitude that we haven't seen at the scales that Cassini has been able to observe. There are almost certainly mysteries that await at the scales that we'll be able to explore with Dragonfly compared to the data from orbit that Cassini took.
I am literally shaking my head in additional wonder over this mission. Anything else that you want to say about other instruments on the spacecraft, how we're going to learn what Dragonfly will be able to tell us about Titan?
The primary science we want to accomplish is understanding the prebiotic chemistry on Titan that may be so similar to the chemistry that occurred here on the early Earth. And so the mass spectrometer allows us to get the chemical details. And we have a complement of instruments that allow us to get context for those compositional measurements. A gamma ray and neutron spectrometer, this allows us to get the bulk elemental composition and even information about very near surface layering beneath the lander. So that's very complementary to the very detailed chemistry we'll do at the drill sites. We can get the larger scale, the lander scale composition with the gamma ray and neutron spectrometer. And again, this is based on technology that has flown on Messenger and is being developed for the Psyche mission. And then we also have a meteorology and geophysics package. Of course, we want to be able to understand the weather on Titan and follow it from day to day. We can do atmospheric profiles because we can fly up to different altitudes to measure how the atmosphere changes with altitude. And then we have, as part of the geophysics package, we have a seismometer, so that we'll be able to measure the seismic activity on Titan the same way InSight is doing on Mars right now. Of course, we have a suite of cameras developed by Malin Space Science System. MSCube, of course, has experience developing cameras for Mars and many other spacraft as well. And again, we've
great
learned
place
from
to go
Mars.
For your cameras.
Exactly. And we've learned from Mars, you know, the kind of nesting you want of the different resolutions. And so we'll have a suite of cameras with different imaging scales and different views. Again, we can do observations both from the surface, but also aerial imaging, which will be a lot of fun. And because the high gain antenna is articulated to be able to track Earth, we've mounted two cameras on the high-gain antenna, and those will allow us to do panoramas, to do stereo imaging by moving the high-gain antenna to target the cameras as well. So we'll be able to get, you know, understanding of the geology, the atmosphere, and the subsurface to provide the context to understand how materials have interacted on Titan with the detailed chemistry measurements, to inform the detailed chemistry measurements we'll get with the mass spectrometer.
I can hardly wait, but I will have to wait. I sure hope, Zibi, that we can continue to check in with you as you proceed toward that 2026 launch of Dragonfly toward Titan. And I sure hope, I can't say that I'll still be doing planetary radio, but if I'm here in anywhere in 2034, I look forward to sharing that tremendous excitement with you as Dragonfly flies down to the surface of this really amazing and mysterious world.
Absolutely. We're looking forward to it too.
Thanks again, and congratulations once again, and best of luck as it all comes together.
Thank you.
That's Zibi Turtle, principal investigator for the Dragonfly mission to Saturn's cloud-shrouded moon Titan. Actually, that's only about half of my complete conversation with Zibi. You can hear it all at planetary.org/radio. That's also where we catch up with JPL scientist and engineer Troy Hudson. Troy is part of the effort to save what's fondly called the mole, carried to Mars by the InSight lander. They are making some progress. Back in a minute with What's Up and a LightSail 2 update. This is Planetary Radio.
Where did we come from? Are we alone in the cosmos? These are the questions at the core of our existence. And the secrets of the universe are out there, waiting to be discovered. But to find them, we have to go into space. We have to explore. This endeavor unites us. Space exploration truly brings out the best in us, encouraging people from all walks of life to work together to achieve a common goal. To know the cosmos and our place within it. This is why the Planetary Society exists. Our mission is to give you the power to advance space science and exploration. With your support, we sponsor innovative space technologies, inspire curious minds, and advocate for our future in space. We are the Planetary Society. Join us.
Time for What's Up on Planetary Radio, with a special LightSail report built into it. It's a two-for-one. So we're going to talk to the chief scientist for the Planetary Society, who is also the LightSail program manager. Bruce Betts is still up there in San Luis Obispo. Hey, give us the status. It's a little different from what we thought we might be able to say today.
Well, yes, if you want to look at it that way. The important things is we've got a healthy spacecraft in a stable orbit, and we're communicating with it on a daily basis, quite frequently. As happens with complex spacecraft, we have been finding various issues and then fixing them. And particularly right now, we're working issues with the attitude determination and control software, ADCS, and how it's speaking and getting information from some of the sensors. And so we're spending the next few days working those issues because we have to do software and other fixes and then upload them to the spacecraft. We have limited communication. So we are not going to deploy the sail until at least July 21st so we can really have the ADCS in a good situation, which we'll need when we have that sail out. We're getting pretty pictures back too, kind of slowly, but we're just releasing some. So check out planetary.org or sail.planetary.org. You can also check out the dashboard that's there and see what the status of the spacecraft is and where it is at any given time.
And we'll have links to all of that, including this brand new, gorgeous image of Earth taken by LightSail 2.
Yeah, I'm pretty happy about that.
You should be. It's amazing. And you know who else is happy? A lot of our listeners, many of whom are members. This from Jose Costa in Brazil, who says he's feeling very proud to be part of the Planetary Society since 2001. And this from Chris Beck, Christopher Beck, who was there with us. I got to say hi to him at the launch, the Falcon Heavy launch that put LightSail to where it is now. Cheers from Williamsburg, Virginia. It took me 2 hours to get the 2 miles back to my car from the Saturn V Center after the launch. Christopher, we take no responsibility for the traffic leaving the Kennedy Space Center, but but we've got more What's Up stuff to do before we get back to LightSail. What is up?
Well, on July 16th, there's a partial lunar eclipse visible from throughout most of Europe, Africa, Central Asia, and the Indian Ocean, so that'll be cool. And we've got planets in the evening sky. We got Jupiter still dominating the evening sky, looking super bright in the evening in the south. And then Saturn is at opposition, opposite side of the Earth from the sun. And so that means it's rising around sunset, setting around sunrise, looking yellowish in the east in the early evening. She mentioned Jupiter is also still hanging out near the reddish star Antares in Scorpius, which is bright but much dimmer than Jupiter. And the moon is feeling left out, so it will visit Jupiter on the 13th and Saturn on the 15th.
Was this a big week in space?
This was a very big week in space, Matt, and we had the first ever Mars flyby, Mariner 4, in 1965. The Apollo 11 launch, you may have heard of that, 50 years ago this week. 40 years ago this week, Skylab reentered the atmosphere and did not hit us. And then just 4 years ago, New Horizons did its flyby of the Pluto system. Big, big week.
I bet you have a random space fact for us.
This time I do. Random space fact.
Which, of course, I should have gotten from Zibby Turtle, but you know how it is.
That's okay. I enjoy it. I'm sorry, everyone. I am just absorbed in LightSail, too, so you're going to get all LightSail all the time for a little while. LightSail 2 transmits a beacon with spacecraft engineering data every 7 seconds and a so-called continuous wave or CW Morse code signal every 45 seconds. The CW is LightSail 2's FCC call sign, which, of course, is WM9XPA. And that's transmitted in Morse code. The signals are centered on 437.025 megahertz for those who want to listen in.
Yeah, and I've heard from a couple of hams who did pick up the signal. What are those call letters again?
Those call letters are WM9XPA.
There really ought to be a little radio jingle to go with that, you know, like an old 60s, 70s radio jingle. This is WM9XPA in orbit.
That's magnificent. Don't hurt yourself.
Thank you. Thank you.
You're proud of yourself on that one. Like, you
I know.
Be.
I really am.
You should be. Yeah. That was beautiful.
I have to go copyright that. Okay, on to the contest.
All right, on to the contest. I asked you in my LightSail 2 fit of fitness, what does the label on LightSail 2 on its mini DVD which contains the names of all members and backers of Lightsail and contributed names and selfies. What does the label on the mini DVD say that's flying in space right now? How do we do, Matt?
First, from Joseph Poutre in Fanwood, New Jersey. He says, I'm certain you've heard this one an excessive number of times, so I'm trying a variation. Because it is in space in near vacuum, it cannot say anything. You must read it. Guess what, Joseph? We heard that from absolutely no one else. Here is the person I think who is our winner, chosen by random.org. It's Daniel Huckabee in North Las Vegas, Nevada, who says that printed on the DVD, the mini DVD, is Lightsail, citizen-funded flight by light.
That is correct.
Congratulations to you, Daniel. You are going to be getting a Planetary Society kick asteroid, rubber asteroid, a 200-point iTelescope.net account, and a beautiful graphic novel, Apollo, by Fitch Baker and Collins. The Collins is Michael Collins, as we mentioned before, but not that Michael Collins. It's all about the mission of Apollo 11 and the three astronauts who became the heroes of that mission. It really is a great graphic novel. We will put that stuff in the mail. He also says, as a new member of the Planetary Society, as of only April this year, I probably missed the deadline to be put on the CD. Beautiful launch, though. What an amazing group to be part of for my passion for space. Nicely put, Daniel.
Yes, it's lovely.
All right, we're ready to move on.
Did I mention I'm thinking a lot about Lightsail too? This is a little bit broader question. However, I may have discussed this already. I'm throwing you a bone here. With regards to spacecraft, what does ADCS stand for? I can't get it out of my thoughts right now. Go to planetary.org/radio contest.
You have until the 17th, that'll be July 17, Wednesday at 8 a.m. Pacific time, to get us this answer regarding that abbreviation, which is haunting the dreams of Dr. Bruce Betts. and you know, you might win yourself a 200-point iTelescope.net account, that account for doing astronomy remotely from anywhere on, they have telescopes all over our planet. We'll throw in a Planetary Society kick asteroid, rubber asteroid. And can you spare another copy of Astronomy for Kids?
I can do that.
Well, that's it. It's Astronomy for Kids, except that it's not just for kids. It's Bruce's great book, if I do say so myself, A Guide to the Night Sky, whether you're doing naked eyes, binoculars, or a telescope. It's pretty cool. We'll put that in the prize package as well. And that means we're done.
All right, everybody, go out there, look up the night sky, and think about what you'd put on your DVD label in space. Thank you. Good night.
I hope you're enjoying life in San Luis Obispo because you're going to be there for a while longer.
You know, it's beautiful. And every day when I walk outside to head over Cal Poly, I think, gosh, this is lovely. I'm going to go spend the next many hours inside.
It is a great town. And a great campus. That's Bruce Betts. He is the program manager for Lightsail and the chief scientist of the Planetary Society, who joins us every week here for What's Up. Planetary Radio is produced by the Planetary Society in Pasadena, California, and is made possible by our members who take flight almost every day. Mary Liz Bender is our associate producer. Josh Doyle composed our theme, which was arranged and performed by Peter Schlosser. I'm Matt Kaplan. Ad Astra.